Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Was Nephi a Mormon? Thoughts on cultural conflict in Mormonism, in case you're lost. Okay, to introduce David Knowlton, our person giving the paper today. David's a graduate of the University of Utah with a BA in anthropology. He has his master's and PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, and also in anthropology. His thesis dealt with a conversion to Mormonism of peasants in Bolivia. He's done extensive field work among Mormons in Texas and in Bolivia also, and was a missionary for the LDS Church in Bolivia between 1974 and 1976. Responding to his paper will be Marie Cornwall, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Brigham Young University.
Before I even begin, I have to apologize to y'all. I just recently, a day or so ago, got off a plane from Peru. My baggage made it okay. Unfortunately, my voice didn't. So if there are pauses and falterings in the voice, blame it on Atahualpa or something like that. Once, in my branch in La Paz, Bolivia, a very dedicated young man was called to teach the gospel doctrine class. Elias was serious-minded. Generally, he passed his days reading and studying what few texts were available on the gospel in Spanish. For him, this meant a lot. Since he was an Aymara speaker, born in a rural village, until recently, education and literacy had been denied his people. For almost a century, they have been struggling to obtain schooling as a means of reasserting and revalidating their ethnic identity and their position vis-a-vis the Spanish-speaking elites in the country. Of only about 25 years old, Elias had left his rural community, obtained an education, worked as a radio announcer and journalist on the new Aymara language radio, and he had joined the church. His becoming a member cannot be separated from his own and his people's struggle for social change. Poignantly, Elias was slowly dying from tuberculosis. When his call came, he was unable to hold down a job because of physical weakness. The resulting devastating poverty exacerbated his tuberculosis, but his will and spirit could not be defeated. His faith in God and his pleasure in his new religion kept him going. The first Sunday that Elias stood before the congregation in his ragged but carefully cleaned and patched clothes, he glowed with humble excitement and the effort of preparing. He had just begun the lesson when about half the class stood and left. In the hall, they vociferously complained at the insult of having an Indian as their Sunday school teacher. Ultimately, because the branch president and the missionaries who worked with him would not give in, Elias continued to teach. But many of the members of the branch stopped coming until Elias died. Such conflicts, in my experience, are relatively common in the church, although they're often more silent and more devastatingly felt than the example I just read. Although we might wish it, the church is not a neutral participant in the tensions and struggles of the wider society in which it develops. There is significant diversity in the church. Within any ward, there are widely varying worlds of experience that somehow attempt to come together, to build bridges, allowing them to function. Despite their best efforts to become brothers and sisters, following our common metaphor of membership, conflict based on cultural difference periodically breaks out. Inevitably, this defies the image of community that we hope to obtain within the church. It makes it difficult sometimes for us to resolve these issues of conflict with the image of community. It makes it difficult to speak about them. But I think they're a very important aspect of us as members of the church. It's not just community, but it's conflict and community that we need to understand. Some of the most telling of these diverse worlds of experience involve language and ethnic difference. Unfortunately, these are also the easiest to discuss, but they only compose the tip of the icebergs that course our sea of apparent unity. The great Mexican thinker Octavio Paz wrote, "I conceive of literature as a dialogue with the world, with the reader, and with myself. And dialogue is the opposite of that noise that denies us and the silence that ignores us. Following Octavio Paz, I conceive of Mormonism as a discussion group, as an organization of diversity, in which many different perspectives share and sometimes compete for the floor, and in which for a while one or another may even take the main stage, but on separate side, perhaps isolated stages like Sunstone, other diverse perspectives continue to be performed. Unfortunately, in the church as a whole, there's often too much noise and too much silence denying and ignoring Mormon diversity. Much of the silence and the noise stems from a number of assumptions about Mormonism which we tacitly and uncritically hold. For example, there is the common idea that the church is the same wherever you go. Following this idea, a member should be able to go to any place and feel at home because the gospel and the church are the same. We often contrast this with a Catholicism which we condescendingly call apostate, that is syncretized with many local customs as it has crossed the globe. So that Catholicism is practiced among the Indians in Mexico may not be the same as Catholicism practiced in Rome. We see this as sort of a perversion of primitive Christianity. But let me ask a question. What constitutes sameness? What are the criteria we use to decide if a given ward is the same as another? How can we know? How do we know? How do we decide to emphasize some things instead of other things? Unfortunately, although they're important, these criteria remain tacit, yet we still make comparisons. In a sense, these form an ideological minefield because they conflate cultural similarity with religious acceptability and truth. As a result, we seldom discuss them except in the negative. We generally are aware only of practices, doctrines, styles, and so on that we disapprove of. We often strategically ignore fundamental differences for reason of convenience. For example, we seldom discuss the radical organizational differences between our church and the form the gospel took in the Book of Mormon. Organizationally, we, Latter-day Saints in the late 20th century, are more similar to Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, than we are to Nephites, Jaredites, Lamanites, and so on. Yet we consider ourselves different from the Protestants and the same as the Nephites. Once again, the question, how do we know what is the same and what is different? The church in Nephi's time didn't have Sunday school, didn't have primary. We could add a list of the things it didn't have. How can we say, then, that we have the same that they had when we have Sunday school and so on and so on, which we share in common with the Protestants? We share a hymn tradition. We share a tremendous amount of our religious culture with the Protestants around us. I think it's worth arguing that in many ways we're more similar to Protestants than we are to Nephites. Yet we consider ourselves to be the inverse. So how do we know what is the same and what is different? Well, obviously, these observations cannot depend on an empirical enumeration of cultural traits. Rather, we must ask, what are the hidden criteria that value certain empirical facts as more or less crucial than others? Let me play the anthropologist game and take an exotic example, okay? To illustrate this, in the Alto Vopes region of Colombia, the people organize themselves in terms of language. They practice what is known as linguistic exogamy, which simply means that a man must marry someone who speaks a different language than himself. That would mean those of us who speak English can't marry English speakers. We have to marry German speakers or French speakers or Spanish speakers or Navajo speakers. A Navajo speaker would have to marry an English speaker and so on and so on and so on. So within a single longhouse, which may be, you know, a man with his children and the children then marries, so there may be five or six wives, there are going to be many unrelated languages that are spoken. You know, we think we have problems communicating in our families. How'd you like to have different languages spoken within the family? And without any language schools to help you learn the other languages. Nonetheless, people grow to understand those languages they interact with, even though linguists consider them to be formally unintelligible. So let's ask for a minute, how do you define a community? If you're going to define a community or a culture on the basis of language, then we'd have to split the fundamental social unit, the longhouse, in a way that defies reason. We'd have to take one wife here and put her with the community over here and this wife over there, instead of looking at the longhouse with its multitudes of languages. So what I'm arguing is we need to understand the people's way of defining their similarities and differences with others. We need to know why particular means of definition were chosen among all the possibilities presented by human variability. That means that, yes, we are the same as the Nephites. But again, what are the criteria that we use to allow us to say that Nephi was a Mormon? Well, this implies the question of what Mormonism really is. How do we know when we're dealing with Mormonism? You know, we talk about it, we live it, we preach it, we grow with it. But what is it? How do you simply define it? What indexes it? What represents it? What are the defining minimal criteria for Mormonism? This is not just an abstract philosophical question. It's also an important missionary question. How do you know where you've imparted Mormonism? You can't know unless you know what it is. Well, it's a tendency in our culture to settle on aspects of belief, to try to get a list of basic beliefs. You know, if we're going to compare religions, we want to get their beliefs and compare and contrast them. But this, you know, is a part of an ideology that stems only from the West. Religion is much more than just belief. It's also practice. It's also ritual. Religion is also life in general. So then if we look at social organization, temporal structure, etc., to define Mormonism, then Mormonism is going to change when it changes. I'm not going to offer an answer to the question of what Mormonism is. I think, though, that it's an important issue for debate. Instead of something to just assume that we know what it is something we should worry about, ask about, and indeed study in its different varieties. Everywhere, well, let me start over again. The people who rejected Elias as their Sunday school teacher thought they knew what Mormonism was very simply. It depended on some analyses that they had of the social order. Mormonism, for them, seemed to validate them. It was very much a part of it that I, as an outside observer, would look at and describe as racist. But to them, this was an important part of the gospel. These people spoke Aymara, and biologically they were Indians, as was he. The problem between them and Elias came from their perception of the social order. They considered themselves mestizos and felt that Elias call was a direct threat to their social position and prestige. From their perspective, people like Elias should have the right to belong to the church as long as they stayed in their place. That is, positions of leadership should only go to persons occupying at least mestizo status on the social hierarchy. Even though this kind of attitude contradicts the common Mormon notion that the Lord should call anyone to a position, depending on his wisdom, it exemplifies the kinds of unexamined cultural assumptions behind much process and procedure in the church. Everywhere within the church, similar kinds of tacit criteria inform who is chosen for church callings and whether those choices are going to be accepted as legitimate by other members. In Elias' case, he would never have been called if it had not been for a North American missionary who was not part of the native culture, who had thereby different tacit assumptions. This missionary cajoled the reluctant branch president, the native, into making the call against his better judgment. Simply because missionary felt like it, since I was the missionary, and felt the inspiration, it was part of his calling. But also because Elias was one of the most faithful members of the struggling branch, and because he definitely had the best knowledge of the gospel among the available members for the calling. He was also one of the most worthy. It seemed like the right call. Little did I expect the reaction. Later, the missionary and his companion lectured the members for their unchristlike behavior, almost causing a generalized rebellion on the part of the members against these, there's no way of translating it, but these gringos antipáticos, which means these antisocial gringos. But in the United States, we generally are unaware of the cultural criteria behind the selection of people for callings in our wards and branches. Tellingly, many worthy people never have a calling because they're culturally different. They may have different political ideals, maybe from a different background, but for one reason or another, they don't fit into the network, which then leads to callings. But to discuss this openly, as we're doing right now, seems to bring us into apparent conflict with the notion that calling should come solely by inspiration. We are so anxious to see the hand of God in all things that we neglect to see the hand of mankind there as well. In 1979, there was generalized unrest in the branch of Huaquillo, Bolivia. This branch had been the miracle branch of the Bolivian mission, where almost overnight, the people had accepted Mormonism. In fact, it was even written up in the church news and then was preached about from General Conference as an example of how the Spirit of the Lord moves upon all people. The mission president was often fondly called it the best branch in Bolivia. Yet Huaquillo was fragmenting because of cultural tensions within it, between itself and the mission. In Aymara culture, there are at least two kinds of leaders. Generally, leadership is a kind of diffuse thing, and a person occupies a position only as a burden carrier for the people. Decision-making remains with a group. It's kind of a democracy. It's not a republican system where you have leaders who stand for the masses and are able to make decisions. Rather, you have to have a town meeting. Everybody has to come together and make decisions. The leader then carries them out. But he cannot make decisions for himself. Okay. The system in an Aymara community attempts to prevent the usurpation of group rights by individual strong men. The other kind of leader within the communities or among the communities is a strong man. But to become one, he must build a following of people dependent on him in order to avoid the anger that naturally develops over anyone who attempts to centralize power. Both kinds appear over and over in the history of the Bolivian Altiplano. On the one hand, you have this very diffuse kind of democracy, and then on the other hand, you have people who agglomerate power and become strong men. And these two systems exist in a real constant tension, the one always fighting against the other. In Huaquillo, shortly after the church appeared, the missionaries were withdrawn and a native was called as branch president. For 3 years, he held the calling, creating suspicion among the other members of the branch. They feared that he was agglomerating power for his own purposes. They felt that the branch presidency should rotate among the members on a perhaps annual basis. In fact, they could tell you who the next office holder should be. They had their own set of criteria for choosing leadership within the church. In fact, if a change did not occur, if the branch presidency did not rotate soon, they threatened to leave the church, denying thereby the man a base for his becoming a sort of strong man. Ultimately, the change did occur, but not before various members did go inactive. Since then, the presidency has rotated, not exactly as the community might like, but enough similarity exists to avoid the permanent abandonment of the church by the members of the community. In this case, cultural pressures conflicted clearly with the hierarchical pretensions of the church, but for the time being, they managed to coexist. Let me mention the mission presidency, to my understanding, has no knowledge of what was going on in Huaquillo. They really don't understand the cultural pressures, and you've got to believe in some sort of spiritual inspiration because it was definitely a tension point, and the church came very close to losing an entire branch, the miracle branch, because they were keeping a man in the branch presidency too long, leading to potential agglomeration of power. And, you know, the church is going to find there are going to be these tensions between its leadership and the styles of the people. The church still doesn't understand this point in Bolivia, the church leadership, the mission presidency, and it'll continue breaking out as long as the church doesn't manage to somehow grasp a hold or seize the line of thought of the natives. Often when we discuss people's leaving the church or going inactive, we avoid the cultural reasons behind their alienation. We prefer to see their departure in moral terms. Thus, in the case of Huaquillo, the mission leaders and others would not discover the conflict between Anglo criteria and the Aymara understanding because their culture indicates that people go inactive because of moral turpitude. Instead of understanding it in cultural terms as a cultural conflict, they would look for sins to explain the people's decision. Let me take a less exotic example. In a case from Yale, a famous social scientist left the church because of what he claimed were serious intellectual differences. Another physical scientist, who happened to be in the same ward, insists that the real reason he left the church was because he just didn't want to keep the commandments. Both positions are partial. In fact, people often do change their behavior upon breaking with the church as kind of a symbolic means of differentiating themselves, distinguishing themselves. But that cannot be seen as the only or even the primary cause of their difficulties. Alienation develops for many reasons, not the least of which are feelings of not belonging. I don't know why the social scientist left the church, nor why he was subsequently excommunicated. But I do know that in Wakuyu, if there had not been the conflict over cultural assumptions, many of those people who are now inactive would still be functioning members of the branch. Let me mention that in Wakuyu, every single young man who's gone on a mission has left the church. The branch struggled to put their young people in the mission field. They hadn't even been a branch for 2 years, and they started sending people out in the mission field, a great sacrifice to the branch. And they've been very disappointed when these young men come back to the community and go inactive. There are very strong conflicts there that I won't get into right now. But a lot of it has to do with cultural assumptions and cultural pretensions, particularly the kinds of cultural ideals the young men learn in the mission field, which then don't fit into the community hierarchy when they return. And as a result, their members sort of ostracize them over time until the young missionaries decide, hey, what the heck? People already think I'm a devil. I may as well act like one. So they do. I think that it's important that we break the silent assumption that subsumes cultural differences to moral questions. I think that each moral and cultural needs to be seen in its own right. There are many silent and noisy assumptions that impede our understanding of cultural diversity and conflict. In a collection of essays on issues of culture and the spread of the church throughout the world, the church is often idealized. This volume was edited by Tullis and published in 1976, BYU Press. But the church is often idealized and conflated with the gospel as a, quote, culture that transcends time and space. For example, Reynolds claimed that the gospel is subversive of worldly cultures. I don't understand this. If this indeed were the case, then the gospel would be subversive of itself since it also exists in the world. Similarly, Thomason argued that, the people to whom we are to deliver the fullness of the gospel have been influenced by religions that have their origins, at least in part, in apostasies from the many previous dispensations of the gospel, unquote. Furthermore, Nibley extended this position by claiming that there is a gospel culture, composed of, quote, everything good, unquote. These scholars base themselves on a concept of culture that participates in a particular class position, in that it attempts to define a high culture that should be normative, that should be the ideal, against which all other cultures can be and should be judged. Not only does this stem from the history of European thought and class conflict, while society changed in ways that befuddled the elites, they came up with this idea of high culture to take away reality from the lower class, working class cultures that would challenge them. At the same time, it also stems very naturally from our discussion of dispensations and Mormon traditions. But unfortunately, it will never allow us to appreciate why there is diversity and the conflicts coming from that diversity, since it provides a moral high ground that is too easily appropriated to deny other people's legitimacy. Too often, this position enables diversity to be dismissed as mere apostasy, instead of being appreciated as a legitimate human response to complex and ever-changing situations. If we somehow prioritize this ideal gospel and perform sort of a cultural sleight of hand, leaking it with a temporal church, as if there were no tensions in the idea, and as if the gospel itself were not a temporal and human phenomenon, then we make it impossible to appreciate the cultures of others. In fact, people sense very quickly the condescension inherent in this position. For example, in the records of the Bolivian mission, there are ample references to the benighted natives and the unfortunate customs that they're going to have to change when they become members of the church. What are these customs, and what is the reference point for assuming them wrong? In the cases from Bolivia, they include a wide range of social patterns that are thoroughly interwoven in the fabric of society, from norms of personal conduct through festivals and social organization. The Anglo leaders viewed norms different from their own and assumed that because they were different, they would have to change, never even argumentatively establishing some sort of contradiction between these patterns of behavior and the gospel. Just they were different from Anglo norms, so they had to change. So you find contradictions like within the Bolivian church. The Anglo missionaries and leadership have struggled to teach the people about Santa Claus and American Christmas and the Easter Bunny, yet they've waged war against things as simple as wearing black in honor of your dad. Excuse me. Cultural understanding requires that we recognize the temporality in our own culture. It forces us to turn our gaze inward to question our own biases and positions. This does not mean that we discard them because we find out suddenly that they have feet of clay. It merely means that we recognize in ourselves what we see in others, according them as much legitimacy as we seize for ourselves. Therefore, we need to understand or to undertake detailed and careful analyses of our culture and its workings. Our culture, I mean Mormonism, particularly the Anglo-Saxon variant that many of us practice. We need to take analyses and studies of our values, our assumptions, and their change in varieties. The idealization prevalent in Tullis's volume do not use the concept of culture developed by anthropologists. It's a very different understanding of culture. Here, culture refers to more than just conscious beliefs or worldview of a people. It includes their whole style of life, their technology, as well as the unconscious motivations deep within their mind. This vague but extremely useful concept includes a few essential points. One, culture is extra-individual. It exists beyond the individual. It cannot be reduced to biology or psychology. And thirdly, it cannot be reduced to any sort of individual entity. Culture is not a thing like a stone that can be very easily handled, modified, and analyzed. In fact, it has a curious ability to change whenever the analyst writes it down and to be dependent on particular situations. Thus, it appears in a given context, but does not in others. Furthermore, the analyst can never have but a partial picture of it. When working with small-scale, bounded societies, it makes sense to call them a culture. However, for societies as complex as our own, it's very difficult to limit things to a culture versus another culture. Nipley's viewpoint and that of others locates the gospel in the domain of a specialist, ignoring that even our theologians and other scholars do not agree what Mormon is. We need to illuminate the shifting and often contested boundaries between these domains of expertise and common sense. We seem to have the idea that the gospel is a defined domain that should be unified, thus divergence seeming apostasy and syncretism to be avoided. Yet as non-Mormon scholars have indicated, such as Leone, one has only to listen to the common members to find out that there is a variety of gospels subsumed within Mormonism. If there is theological unity, it exists more in the rarefied domains of abstracting scholarship than in the complex provinces of daily life in the church. The Lord may know what the gospel is. He may be clearly able to identify what is true and what is false. He may easily comprehend the difference between pure truth and truth compromised by syncretism. But we as human beings, in other than a partial way, cannot. Hence our need to struggle for our salvation. In terms of Mormon thought, we can, to a degree, learn the truth line upon line, precept upon precept, until we reach a celestial state. But following the thought of social science, it is impossible for us to step aside from our human reality. Even our simple perceptions of the mountains and valleys around us are colored by our culture. Hence, syncretism is not something to be avoided. It is rather one of the basics of life. To argue that we can determine what is pure, correct Mormonism and what is not is to attempt a relationship of power. It suggests the ability of some people to impose their perspectives on others, an ability that often has some sort of material economic basis. In the church, there are those who attempt to determine the legitimacy of others' behavior and ideas. For example, the church's hierarchy legitimately performs this routinely as a means of social control, for example, in temple recommend interview. But they aren't the only ones. There are also many members in our individual wards, and that probably includes all of us in one way or another, who for one reason or another have the hubris to judge the legitimacy of other people's places in the church, forgetting the dictum of the New Testament to judge not. Despite what the New Testament says, these judgments exercise an important place within the church in building and maintaining cultural boundaries. But they're boundaries that, once again, we understand in moral terms and often don't see for what they are. The hierarchy legitimately uses power to make its decisions to give some people callings and deny them to others. But that's not the only place power operates. Within the wards, the members are often stratified according to their culture and access to power. Inevitably, the position of a person within the cultural rankings limits the ways that they can benefit from their membership in our religious community. To begin to even grapple with these issues, we need very careful ethnographies, exemplary of the varieties of Mormonism. It is hard to understand Mormonism in Bolivia without having explored what has been called Deseret Mormonism. Similarly, within the United States, there are regional, ethnic, and occupational varieties of our common religion that need definition. We must understand their differences and similarities, as well as the various processes that lead to the fragmentation and agglomeration. It is telling, though, that almost no one has seriously studied Mormonism outside the United States, ethnographically, or for that matter, in regions beyond the Mountain West, or in ethnic groups other than the Anglo. Cultural appropriation goes on here, where those of us from the Deseret culture assume that ours is the Mormon culture, and others must convert into it, when in reality, many different varieties have developed and continue to develop. With that in mind, I offer some scattered observations of places I have lived and the various social groupings in my branches and wards. Excuse me. Mormonism has grown phenomenally during the last decades in Latin America. In many countries, for example, Bolivia, Chile, Peru, the church is now reported to be the second most numerous church after the Roman Catholic. As such, it is coming into a position of power and influence, as well as social prominence, which inevitably will have political implications. The church cannot opt out of the socio-political life of the continent. Even silence here is political. In fact, the church, consciously or not, has taken sides in the struggles that frequently shake the continent. Often, we are puzzled when leaders of different movements challenge us with bursts of criticism on why we take what we see as a non-political, quote-unquote, stance. But, nonetheless, we still must participate, and it'd be helpful to analyze openly what the political position is instead of just taking it tacitly. But let me turn to more of the influence the church has. Its influence, social influence, is further exemplified by the ostentatious and very prominent chapels it has built throughout the continent, as well as temples and even office buildings. These have raised a lot of controversy. People argue, not members oftentimes, but non-members, argue that the church should spend more money performing works of social benefit rather than monumental edifices, particularly when the poverty and suffering on the continent is as great as it is. Importantly, though, the church apparently has imposed a uniformity similar to the buildings. Interestingly as well, within these buildings, one finds a variant of Mormon culture that we could call Latin American Mormonism. It's a variant that really needs discussion and thought. It's growing rapidly. It's different in many fundamental ways than what we Latter-day Saints here in the valleys of the West practice. It certainly has different political ideals, and the ideals, the values of the buildings are very different than we see them. We see these more as humble buildings. They see them more as ostentatious buildings. Why? Well, what's humble for us is very ostentatious in an environment where people build with adobe and live in small one-room houses with dirt floors. What is humble for us, cinder block construction, very plain, is very ostentatious in a brown land where people are struggling, where the elites are very hard struggling to differentiate themselves from the masses in a fitful burst of conspicuous consumption. Ironically, though, we find ourselves changing positions with the Catholics. I remember when I was a missionary, we'd often go into the ornate colonial chapels and sort of look at them condescendingly as a sign of the apostasy. We saw a rich church at the time exploiting the people for its own institutional ostentatiousness and wealth. We'd think of the poor and suffering people trampled under the feet of the Roman church. Ironically, now in Bolivia, people criticize us for doing the same thing, using the very same arguments. But the only thing that's changed is historical process. Now the Catholics are arguing in favor of the socially humble, while we build institutional monuments. The irony has to make you chuckle, because as I said, in Utah, we view the chapels differently. Latin America is a very diverse continent, with many ethnic groups and even different languages. In the relatively uniform city of La Paz, Bolivia, hundreds of languages are spoken, although two dominate numerically, Spanish and Aymara. The church, though, works almost alone with one, Spanish. The only reason Spanish is because, hey, it has a lot of literature. It has books. You can go to school and study Spanish. It's not the numerically most important language in Bolivia. It is, though, the language of power, the language of politics, the language of government. Thereby, the church gives itself willy-nilly a particular social-political identity and affiliates itself with relatively elite social groups, whether it wants to or not. Generally in Bolivia, the membership of the group comes only from urban sectors. The mission leaders in the countries have thrown up their hands consciously, essentially giving up on the roughly 65% of the population of the Lamanites that lives in the countryside and does not speak Spanish, but rather have the chutzpah to speak a Lamanite tongue. For various reasons, the church leadership have not figured out how to modify our heavily structured and now very urban, unlike the former Mormon rural village organization, our very urban wards to fit in with the social organization of the rural Andes. In this area, the rural zones speak Aymara and hold cultures that are related to but very different from the predominantly Spanish-speaking urban zones. In Bolivia, we are now a Spanish-speaking church, existing in a multilingual environment. We use the language of power and dominance, unlike the more successful Protestant churches of the rural zone. They modified their organization to fit in more with Aymara social organization and to use the Aymara language. So here in this area of Bolivia, if you look at it from the perspective outside the church, you find Anglo-speaking, Spanish-speaking, and Aymara-speaking members. And if you rank these people in terms of prestige, then you have a ranking of Anglo-speaking, Spanish-speaking, and Aymara-speaking members. Just that way. Top Anglo, middle Spanish, and bottom, very bottom, Aymara. Interestingly, this corresponds with the traditional class ranking of Bolivian society, in which language, ethnicity, and culture become crucial means of socially defining socioeconomic class. So that you would have, in traditional Bolivian understanding things, you'd have the criollos, the whites, the Spanish at the top. You have the mestizos, the mixed bloods in the middle, and the Indians on the bottom, always on the bottom. In the country as a whole, the ethnic ranking has recently sparked very deep and strident political movements. There are now Indianist political parties and labor movements, as well as cultural clubs, which seek to invert the social order, giving positive value to the lower Indians of society. Let me tell you, I was in Bolivia last week. I had to cross over from Peru. I almost didn't make it because the Indians are blocking the roads in a direct challenge against the government. This is not just a paper movement, nor is it kind of a little group that gathers together in cottages, an isolated group that wants to discuss what being Indian means. It's a very serious political challenge to the dominance of Spanish in the society. Church hasn't caught on to this yet in Bolivia. In the Methodist Church, though, the Aymara-speaking pastors and members recently did a coup. They wrested control of their congregations from the Spanish-speaking elites, making the Methodist Church now an Aymara church and putting the Spanish-speaking members in a position of alienation and marginality. This has been a very bitter struggle within the Methodist Church. It's been similar to the ones that have happened throughout the society. Protestantism has been very important in fomenting positive Indian identity. In our church, we cannot assume that we will not experience these conflicts. In fact, there are young Mormons in Bolivia of my acquaintance who are asking themselves, why does the church favor Spanish and Anglo identity at the expense of our Indian roots? We talk about Lamanites in the Book of Mormon, then why do we reject them? Nevertheless, I suspect that part of the answer comes because many members of the urban church joined that church precisely as a refuge from Indian pressures. They come from the ranks of the formerly rural mestizos. When Indians did a revolution in 53 against the rural social structure, thoroughly overturning it, these people fled to the city to escape Indian control of the economies and towns. And now, in our Spanish-speaking church, in a city that's quickly coming under Indian cultural domination as well, they find a justification for themselves as mestizos while avoiding the politically and growingly more powerful Indians. Someday I'd like to really study this issue. For now, I can merely say that this already creates significant tension among the members of the Bolivian wards and branches. When the Mormons left Nauvoo on their exodus across the plains, they helped appropriate the northern half of Mexico for the United States. In the mesas, canyons, and valleys to the south of Utah, they encountered an important and vital Spanish-speaking population, thus beginning a relation that continues. Despite the Anglo conquest of the Southwest, Hispanic culture remains strong, functioning in constant tension with the idea of the United States as being a solely English-speaking country, or even primarily English-speaking country. In this area, a complex system of ethnic diversity has arisen, something unlike that which is found in other areas of the United States. Because of the historical depth of its ethnic groups and the relative numerical weakness of Anglos, even though the Anglos have economic dominance. Out of this situation, a vibrant Hispanic culture and Hispanic consciousness has arisen, which challenges Anglo dominance. All you have to do is go into the cities of the Southwest and see the tremendous murals that are painted on the walls of buildings, murals of Aztlan, of the homeland to the north. You know, vibrant cultural, one of the most vibrant cultures in the United States right now, in terms of literature and so on, is the bilingual Hispanic culture of our Southwest. But it's a culture that constantly challenges Anglo dominance. This culture appears constantly, and the struggles around it appear in our wards and branches. The simple choice of a particular language in which to conduct a meeting expresses messages of social valuation. Even the kinds of music chosen for meetings or church activities performs the same function, as many other things do as well. A neutral stance would be hard to find, harder to maintain, and almost impossible. Here, because of the attitudes developed within the church over the last 100 and more years in which the church has interacted with this Hispanic culture. When I was a child, I lived in the branch of Las Vegas, New Mexico. For those of you who know the town, it's segregated between Old Town and New Town, with a little stream called Gallinas Creek running down the middle. The one, Old Town, is Spanish. The other, New Town, is Anglo. Similarly, our branch was segregated between the two ethnic groups. Anglos formed the leadership. English was the language of most of the meetings, except for a Spanish-speaking Sunday school class that existed only for a short while. Nonetheless, after the meetings, the melodious strains of Spanish would break through. At one point, when my father was branch president, he'd go to the Spanish Sunday school class. This was interpreted as cultural treason by the Anglos in the ward, leading to an awful lot of conflict. Anglo members shouldn't go to Spanish Sunday school classes. Later on, the stake president from Albuquerque came and ordered the abandonment of a Spanish Sunday school class. After all, this is the United States. We speak English. Together with the standard social politics of the time, this formed a policy, a silent but devastating policy of ethnocide. I don't think any of us would accept ethnocide. Yet it often happens within our ranks when we're unaware of it, because of the silent assumptions we make. The purpose of this policy was to force the Spanish Americans to adopt English as if they had not lived in these mountains, since the United States was a distant idea at the other side of the Great Prairies at the end of the Santa Fe Trail. Next, I lived in a ward in El Paso, Texas. It was hemmed by the border between the United States and Mexico. Unlike much of the city, our neighborhood was predominantly Anglo. Among the members, there were various social groupings. Much of the leadership of the ward and stake came from among those Mormons who originated in the Mormon colonies in Chihuahua in Mexico. This group was thoroughly bilingual. The fact that frequently code switch between English and Spanish, it'd be pretty hard to make them speak straight one language or the other. Another group was composed of Utah Mormons, many of whom struggled with the foreignness of El Paso and with the prevalence of Spanish in the city. The other major group was formed by members who usually were bilingual, but who were labeled as Mexicans, quote unquote. Generally, in our ward, they met at a different time from us and formed a dependent branch, so we generally didn't have to interact. There was a strong social duality in El Paso between, quote, Mexicans, unquote, and, quote, Anglos, unquote, as socially defined. I stress socially defined because, for example, a person I knew who was named Gonzalez was considered Anglo, but someone named Gonzalez was considered Mexican. You know, when I was a child, I didn't even blink at this. It just seemed natural. Someone named Gonzalez was Anglo, and someone named Gonzalez was Mexican. But now I look back and I go, huh? Doesn't make sense, because I now try to bring different criteria to it. We became very conditioned to the subtleties of language use that indicated social and hence ethnic status. When the church decided to close the Spanish wards in South El Paso, the Mexican membership came very close to outright rebellion. For them, this was a major assault on their legitimate place as, quote, Mexicans, unquote, within the church. It seemed a very denial of their right to be Mexican, quote, unquote, and Mormon, quote, unquote, as well. Almost all the leadership in El Paso, and probably the majority of the members, spoke Spanish. We all could have functioned in thoroughly bilingual wards. Nobody did. Our wards were stratified according to ethnic groups, and ultimately the Anglo group moved to make English the sole language of the church, to attempt to make it. But we could have functioned in bilingual wards. We all spoke both languages. But that was not the reality of this ethnically divided and conflictive city. Thus, when the membership made a decision to force people to attend English-speaking wards, whatever their reasoning may have been, they lost many members. Similar events have happened throughout the Southwest when the church summarily closed its Spanish-speaking wards under the guise of promoting desegregation within the church. They have driven many of the Hispanic members away. Another example, I lived for a while in Austin, Texas. The first ward of the church in Austin was a Spanish-speaking ward. That ward was closed under this policy. Most of the members, Spanish-speaking members, went to the Anglo wards for a while. Most did not feel welcome and they left. Let me express it in the words of a very faithful and charming young Mexican-American woman who joined the church while I was in Austin. She said, "It's very frustrating going to an Anglo church. I don't feel that I belong. I still like to go to Mass in Spanish because there I understand and I feel that I belong." People enjoy not being in stress. And when you're contacted or conflicting with another culture, you're always on the defensive, like it or not. As has often been mentioned, in Latin America as a whole, the church has grown phenomenally. Yet in the portion of Latin America belonging to our united union, the church grows very slowly and has severe difficulty retaining its members. To a large extent, this results from the unspoken ideals of what the culture of the church should be. It results from the appropriation of the gospel by a particular social group, ourselves, which then forces others to accommodate themselves to that hegemony if they would belong, quote, to the Lord's church, unquote. A different example comes from Salt Lake City. For 2 years, I attended the Lucero ward, Salt Lake's long-time existing Spanish-speaking ward. In this ward, there are a number of different ethnic groups as well. There are Anglo refugees, who for one reason or another feel more comfortable there than in their English-speaking neighborhood wards, something they often comment on in meetings. There are immigrants from all over Latin America who often join the church in their own countries before coming to Utah. Finally, there are the Mexican-American members, including those who recently came from Mexico, those who come from the lower Rio Grande Valley, and those from southern Colorado and New Mexico. Until recently, the people from Texas, New Mexico, and Colorado formed the bulk of the ward's leadership. For them and their children, many of whom, by the way, did not speak Spanish, the use of Spanish in the ward validated their ethnic identity within Anglo-Utah. It gave them a home to feel that they belonged and that their culture could be valued as a Mormon culture. The ward strongly emphasized Mexican culture, both formally and informally. In fact, it got to the point where those people from South America often felt left out and frequently complained among themselves about the Mexican dominance in the ward. Finally, the South Americans broke and did a coup d'etat on their own and found ways to form a South American ward. And they did this through using the Anglo hierarchy of Salt Lake Stakes in ways that I doubt the Anglo hierarchy still realizes to this day. So right now you fundamentally have three Spanish wards in Salt Lake, one that is predominantly South American, although there are a lot of Mexicans that go there. The other two are predominantly Mexican-American in degradations. One is more so than the other. Even the Lucero ward, though, has been periodically threatened with closing. The stake leaders have held the idea that in the United States, people should speak English. After all, didn't our grandfathers learn English when they came here? So these people would put pressure on the ward. Ironically, as a result of the pressure, the ward members would hide from the stake leadership the amount of English actually used within the ward. So the stake leaders would not have arguments to close the ward down. In its bilingual reality, the Lucero Ward formed an important community for the Chicanos, Mexicano-Americanos, Mexicanos, and Latino-Americanos, where they developed means of surviving in an Anglo-dominated society, and where they maintained their divergent Mormon culture. In conclusion, let me say this discussion is far too cursory. I hope it raises ideas that need scholarly exploration. I think they deserve exploration if we really want to understand Mormonism. The gospel is not some ideal essence. Rather, it lives among people who are Mormons and a little bit more. We are Mormons and Latin Americans, Mormons and Anglo-Americans, Mormons and medical doctors, Mormons and street sweepers, Mormons and feminists, Mormons and conservatives, Mormons and soccer players, and even Mormons and punk rockers. All of these social factors combine in ways that bring considerable diversity to Mormonism, as they also bring about conflict and attempted unity. One cannot separate the culture of soccer players from that of Mormonism per se, except for in the most general and abstract of ways. In the lives of those Mormons who are soccer players, as well as Mormons, both cultures combine vibrantly. Much the same could be said of all of us hyphenated Mormons. Let us examine these issues and our hidden assumptions so that we might engage in a discussion of our diversity, of our existence as Mormons and a little bit more. As Octavio Paz wrote, democracy is dialogue, and dialogue paves the way for peace. Thank you.
I think my comments will be fairly brief on this. I was very interested in the paper. I came to the paper, given the title, with great interest. I came away with a number of questions. Foremost among them was whether or not Nephi was a Mormon. I recognize the importance of catchy titles in symposiums like this, but my curiosity is still raised and not been answered. I suspect David means to tell us that indeed Nephi was a Mormon, but that he probably wouldn't have felt very comfortable in this gathering of people. I asked myself several times, what is this paper really about? Is it a thought piece meant to identify points of strain or imperfections and to remind us of the diversity of people and cultures within the church? Is it a useful scholarly discussion of the extent to which cultural distinctions and ensuing conflicts within Bolivian society is endangering the growth of the church and the spiritual growth of Bolivian members? Or is it an impassioned call for greater introspection about the gospel and how we as Americans, steeped in American culture, can be more sensitive to alternative cultural interpretations? If there is any problem with this paper, it is only that the author is unclear about what he is about, and thus we, or at least I, am unable to respond easily. Let me comment at least on these three statements. If it is a thought piece about points of strain or imperfections in the church, it is a point well taken. David provides several examples of how some members of the church may be disenfranchised by the power structure within a ward or branch. While all examples are primarily from Anglo-American, Latin American, or Mexican experiences, they are true and do exist for several different populations in the church. In the United States, we find the same problems despite similar cultures. We find disenfranchised members among the less educated, among women, and among single members. My own research in the United States and in the British Isles suggests our old assumptions about the role of apostasy and sin related to inactivity is both naive and insensitive. Community and commitment is a central issue in the growth and development and health of a religious group. The loss of community, which led to the destruction of the Nephites and the Lamanites, was fueled by inequality. Our own efforts to build community must confront the necessity of establishing the equal worth of diverse types of people and cultures. Is it a scholarly examination of the cultural problems in Bolivian wards? It almost is, and with more theoretical insights and careful considerations and greater objectivity, I think it could make a major contribution. I wish David would spend more time on focus and detail more in this effort. The example he provides of a trilingual church in Bolivia is fertile ground for the examining the problem of establishing the church in a foreign what we would call a foreign culture. Excuse my slip. The interconnectedness of social class and culture, the opportunity for comparisons with the Methodist Church and the problems they have experienced related to it, and the high growth of the church population make this a study which must be carried out. Having done so and understood it fully, he might be able to provide suggestions about how the church may accommodate to the problem. Let me just say the reason I really focus on that is that I have spent the first 3 months of this year in the British Isles attempting to do just that, and will be spending much of the rest of the year trying to sensitize American church leaders to the cultural assumptions that they're making that get in the way of the growth of the church in the British Isles. In terms of the last area of concern, I want to raise the question of what is the gospel anyway, that as you use the term gospel and refer to it by as what other people are saying. When I say the gospel is true, what do I mean by the gospel? Am I talking about a belief system? Is it a theology? Is it a culture? I don't know how David would answer that question. I don't think it is any of these. Is there such a thing as the pure gospel of Christ? Yes, I think there is. Do I understand it? No, I don't think so. In fact, I do not believe there is anyone in this room who does understand it. Why? For the very reasons that David presents in his paper. I do not have a pure understanding of it because I'm an American, because I was raised along the Wasatch Front, because I was born during the baby boom, and because I am a woman. All of these factors, and others I am unable to list, interfere with my understanding of the pure gospel of Christ. However, I have understood some glimmering of that, of what it means to be saved, to be sanctified, to be loved by God and by His Son. I understand what David is saying when he cautions us about determining what is pure and correct Mormonism. What I wonder is, if we are to take the gospel to every tongue and people of the earth, what is it that we are to take? Surely it is not the cultural assumptions of American Mormonism. My experience in both Mexico and the British Isles suggests that the American gospel is very different from the British and Mexican gospel, and that these two cultural versions are very different from one another. The differences are sufficient for me to wonder if currently our greatest exports, and not meaning efficient exports, but our greatest exports to other countries right now are chapels, activity programs, and organizational structures, most of which do not work. It quotes Reynolds' claim that the gospel is subversive of worldly cultures. I'm confused here. I believe that the gospel is subversive of worldly cultures, but the gospel that Reynolds is talking about does not exist in this world, and it therefore is not subversive of itself. The problem is we do not understand it yet. I believe Nibley's analysis that there is a gospel culture composed of everything good. It just hasn't been created yet, and it will not be created until American Mormons are presented with lesson materials written and correlated by saints in the British Isles, in Japan, in Mexico, and in Bolivia.
Some of you may want to leave for lunch, but if someone would like to stay, we can field some questions.